We're trying to understand God's character better, what he's trying to do with his people. There's a phrase that I remember from my youth. It's called a besetting sin. I don't know if you guys have ever heard this phrase. What is your besetting sin, you know, that you have? Meaning the one thing that gets you every time. We're going to have volunteers to tell us what theirs. Not really. I'm kidding. You guys are getting nervous for a second there. I don't want to do that because you'd ask me what mine was. So how many I have is a better way to put it. If we looked at the nation of Israel and we said, what is their besetting sin? What is the thing that continually buried them as a nation? It's idolatry. Continually through their history, they sought the other gods and followed them and bowed down to them, even though it made no sense at all. I would suggest that you follow other gods because other gods allow you to live in an excess that the God of Israel didn't allow them to live in. And it wasn't that he was a killjoy. It's just that living in that excess destroyed them as people, destroyed them as a nation. So he couldn't love them and allow them to live in that excess because he see that destruction. Many of you care for somebody who right now who's self-destructing. And when they self-destruct, it's almost always because they want to live in excess. It's not because they self-destruct. It's like they said, well, I'm going to deny myself. That's not the way it is. We pick behavioral patterns that allow us to do things that in many ways hurt us. Idolatry became the besetting sin for the nation of Israel throughout their history until the Babylonian captivity. At the Babylonian captivity, when the nation was drug off to Babylon and then later under Persia and then returned, when they returned, never again and until this day has idolatry been the besetting sin of the nation. Many of you might be able to identify with something that's really been hard for you, and then something happens, something difficult happens, and all of a sudden you don't do that one thing anymore that used to be really tough for you. So trials are not always enjoyable, but they can achieve sometimes a good purpose. And in this case, this whole process is going to free them from this pursuit of idolatry. Because obviously in idolatry, you're not focused on God at all. You're focused on some other imagined God that allows you to do whatever you want to do. And in this case, they were not only excesses, but they were brutal excesses. We want to understand God's nature, how he works with people. During this time, Israel underwent a revival, a refocusing on God. We want to know how it happened, why it happened, and if there's anything we can learn from it, we want to learn from that. Last week, we looked at the first chapter of Nehemiah. We saw Israel in exile originally with Babylon, now with Persia, and it started off saying it in the in Nehemiah 1, the words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliel, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year. That month is the end of November, the beginning of summer, beginning of December. And the 20th year means it's the 20th year of the king Artaxerxes. If you remember, Nehemiah encounters a small group of Jews, among them his brother. It's interesting to note his concern for his people and his nation, although they've been there a long time. They're still very nationalistic in terms of their focus and understanding the needs of the nation. He's not lost a focus on God or his promises. That prayer that we read and we'll look at again shows that. And he remembers that God has promised to them a nation. I can't help but draw a little side note sometimes as I think through this. You know, we as believers are also in a strange land. We sort of want to fit in, but it doesn't take you very long in our culture to realize you don't quite fit in. And the world reminds us of that continually. That's okay. In fact, it's probably really good that you don't fit in too much because that fit probably wouldn't be for your betterment. The challenge in this world is not to lose our focus, to remain God's person, God's representative to the fallen world. In this case, Nehemiah doesn't lose his focus. I'm not sure how he has such a balanced view of God. and a balanced view of what God wants to do, but his prayer was remarkable. Even in tough times, including activity, he prays and he doesn't lose focus. In that prayer, he reveals a highly intelligent, advanced knowledge of God. He isn't saying silly things. He isn't asking for silly blessings that he can't get. He also isn't just intellectual. He also reveals a very deep emotional commitment to God and to his nation. It's that same kind of balance that Jesus tried to teach his disciples when he tried to move them away from the pharisaical content of their previous upbringing. The prayer had elements of praise, humility, confession, assurance of God's promise, and requests. In it you find a certain boldness, although Nehemiah is very well of his limitations, his place. If you look in verse 6, and unfortunately, I apologize, I don't have the verse on there. So it says, he said, let your ear be attentive and your eyes be open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night. For your servants, the people of Israel, I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. He's very humble, and not in a general relative way, but in a very specific way, down to his own person. So he's asking then for God to be attentive to him. It's a beautiful and an effective prayer. Nehemiah reminds God of his promise to his people, but he does so humbly, giving God his proper place in authority and assuming his proper place under them. Now, to take an odd little turn here, in your note page that I've handed out, if you picked one up, there's two prayers. There are references to two prayers. On the left column, you see the prayer of Nehemiah, as we've looked at and commented on. On the right, you see the prayer of a nation to God during the Exodus. If you've read Exodus lately or ever, you probably remember the general form there. They've left the nation. They've crossed the Red Sea. They're out in the desert. They're moving toward the Promised Land. And it says, the whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveled from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. Moses replied, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? The people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst? Then Moses cried out to the Lord, what am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me. And the Lord answered Moses and said, go out in front of the people, take with them some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? The word Massa there means testing. The word Meribah means quarreling. So they named it after that. They challenged God in a arrogant, inappropriate way. And I said when we were studying prayer that God is very tolerant. He very puts up with our weaknesses, our limitations, our lack of understanding. But there are times in the Bible where you see that he is not pleased with the foolish challenges of people. Their most foolish question, of course, is the last statement there. Is the Lord among us or not? I'm sorry. Considering what you've seen them, or what they had seen in the Exodus, this is a pretty short-term memory kind of thing. But we all have that same short-term memory, and that's why we have indicated that possibly God does not do many of the most bold acts that we want, because we would just continually ask for one more. There would be no stopping us. If they can't remember that he opened the Red Sea and they marched across and an army followed them and it closed on them, you don't have a very good memory, because those are some pretty bold happenings. We know that God is not pleased with this particular prayer, because when we look in Deuteronomy, if you were to look in Deuteronomy chapter 6, you remember the book of Deuteronomy is a great deal of Moses telling the story of what they've been through before he dies, before they actually enter the land in Joshua. So he's reviewing the things that they've done well and the things that they haven't done well. And here in verse 16 of chapter 6, it says, "Do not test the Lord your God as you did at Massah." So he's telling them that what you did there was a bad thing. So the prayer, if you want to call it a prayer, that they challenged God with did not please God, and God did not respond favorably to that. On the other hand, the prayer on the left column of Nehemiah, who acknowledged God, gave him his proper place, and then put Nehemiah himself in his proper place, so he seemed to please God. And as we continue to read, we'll see that Nehemiah was blessed then with God's blessing as he undertook the task. So if I were you, not that you'd want to do this, but if I were you, I would be looking at what the people in the desert did versus what Nehemiah did, and saying, I'd rather have the result that Nehemiah had rather than the result that they did. I don't really don't want the Lord reminding, don't pray like Ted did, okay, back there, you know, pray like, you know. So the idea is, what are the contents there? What is he doing? Why is that a prayer that pleased God? Why was David a man after God's own heart when he did some really dumb things, but other people weren't? There are certain things that are critical to God, and I think one of them is being truly thankful for what he's done for us and remembering it. And when we forget that and just move on to our next desperate need, as we call it, you know, meaning I don't need a car that's 3 years old, I need a car that's brand new, those kind of desperate needs. I don't think God really probably feels that with us the same as we do. So we don't want to make a mistake in following their example. They were treating God as they would an Egyptian God, not an infinite personal God. In this, we see that God grants his request. So when we go back to Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, we come back to that first story. And we're going to move further down the line to Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 9, which is... remember last week he said he went to the king and he was downtrodden or sad. And he said, the king said, "What's the matter?" And he goes, "My nation's in ruins, and my people are having a tough time." And the king said, "Well, what do you want?" And he said, "Well, I want some funds, and I want some army to get me there, and I want to be able to restore the kingdom of my fathers." And the king of Persia, Artaxerxes, this was their national policy. He said, "Sure, that sounds like a great idea. Go ahead and take people back and do that." So he heads back there. So we're going to pick it up at verse 9, which is the place where he says, "So I went..." "So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king also sent army officers and the cavalry with me." And so when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. So they were enjoying, obviously, the Israelites' tough time. This is about halfway down that page. I apologize. I don't have the verse numbers on there if you saw it. And he said, "I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on." Now, it would be really easy to buzz by that little short verse, but I want to talk about it for a second, the one that says, "After staying there 3 days." This man is taking on a challenge that is huge. He obviously has people around him that are opposed to him. He has a not very cooperative group with him. And he sets and thinks about this for 3 days and plans for 3 days. And I assume because he's a man of prayer, he prays for 3 days. So I think you should take a little word of advice from this, just kind of out of context, possibly, but possibly within the context. If you got a major important decision, it would be good to take a couple of days to think about it rather than jumping into it. When you're mad, do any of you guys ever get upset? I don't remember if you guys are like me or not, but you don't? Okay, I see some no's up here. If you get upset and you're going to go settle with somebody, you know, you're going to go take it to this person, it'd probably be good if you gave yourself about 3 days to think about it before you opened your mouth. If you're going to text somebody something harsh, I don't text harsh things. It's just not my thing. But if you're going to do that, probably give yourself 3 days and then don't send it anyway. Would probably be really good, a really good idea. Now, one disclaimer here. If your wife asks you to take out the trash, I don't think you need to say, I got to pray about this for 3 days and then I'll get to it. So, or if your mom asks you to clean your bedroom, that's maybe not that. But so now that I've given you that information, you can just play that card when you need to. Mom, I'd love to, but I need 3 days to think about this. It's biblical. So anyway, he thinks about it for 3 days. Interesting fellow. I would have liked to have met him. I think he was very wise. And he certainly had experienced some things in his life. And then in verse 12 it says, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except for the one I was riding. And by night I went out through the valley gate toward the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved onward toward the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through, so I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because yet I had said nothing to the Jews or priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. So he takes, after 3 days of thinking about it, he takes a careful look at the challenge ahead of him. You know, to us, raised in America, we don't think about the city walls that much. You know, I mean, it's just not that big a deal to us. Nobody has walls around their city. The marauders aren't coming from North Kenai or something, or Homer, or, you know, or we're not going up there, you know, whatever. You know, we don't think about having to have a really secure little spot, or we're going to be just pillaged. And so it's not our thing. But in the sense of back then, life was cheap. And they know that. They've been drug off in captivity. They've served as slaves to other societies, other cultures. It's a big challenge. And he knows there's going to be resistance. And then he says to him in verse 17, then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. See, back then when you captured an unsubmissive city, you just demolished it. You left everything just in rubble. It was not easily rebuilt. We saw that at the time when we were studying Matthew shortly after Jesus' death. Within 30 years or so, Rome came and just completely demolished the city. No stone left upon another. They said you couldn't even identify that there had been a city there. This is the kind of thing that they did. So to rebuild the walls for security was quite a challenge. And of course, the neighboring nations who didn't like Israel, as long as it was just a mess, they were fine. They knew that the people couldn't defend themselves. So he says, come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. We will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. See, these words are words of revival to them. They're sitting there, getting by. And here comes this guy saying, we can do better things. God has something for us. He has promised us. And when I went to the most powerful person in the world at this time and told him what I wanted, God favorably caused him to grant my request. God is with us. That is an idea of revival. God is with us. He is with me. When I want to raise my family to be mindful of God, God is with me. When I want to have my own personal life be one that's meaningful within the idea of a knowledge of God, God is with me. He will help me do that. I am not alone. Those people feeling they're alone, they're on the fringes of culture now because culture is back in more Babylonian, Persia, back in the Iraqi area where the big cities are. They're on the fringe and they don't feel God is with them. And then Nehemiah, this man shows up, and how does Nehemiah know God is with them? Because God is with him. He's proved it to himself, to his small little, God, will you help me do this? And God is helping him do this. He has a confidence to do that. I like the idea. We talked about not testing God, but isn't there a place for us to try to figure out what God is doing, what he wants to do, what he doesn't want us to do? We can be a little more bold than that, than nothing. Oh, I'm just getting along. Well, that's okay too, but sometimes God can help you do bigger things. And in this case, he's got a big plan for these people. He's letting them in on it slowly though, so that they don't have culture shock. Then they replied, based on what they had heard, let us start rebuilding. They've been there a long time and done nothing. And he said, let us start rebuilding. So the revival is underway. I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, and he's talking about his criticals, the people that are critical of him, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. That's pretty confident. It's pretty bold in a place where he's the minority. He has no military might. The military might rests outside of his control. He's got a bit of okay from the king, Artaxerxes, which certainly helps him to be a little more bold. But life is cheap and everything is tenuous at this time. And then chapter 3, and we're not going to go into it, if you'd like to read that this week sometime, is the story of the rebuilding of the walls. And it talks about who rebuilt each people and their sons, their nobles. Sometimes there's one in there, it's about his daughters help build their part. Verse 12. Repair the next section with the help of his daughters. And remember last week I said, you had to rebuild because if you didn't rebuild your wall well, it was the weakest point. And if they were to invade, they'd come through that point. So you wanted to rebuild it strong and well for the security of the nation. Next week we'll continue to look at the reconstruction of the nation. But the only goal that we're looking at is not the historical goal, but the idea of what is happening to their relationship with God as they go through this experience. And we'll just look then at the revitalization of the nation based on understanding God's promises to them, which are freely given to them. And the same holds true for us. We have God's promises freely given to us, an understanding of his character defined to us through the Bible, and yet we so often get busy and we don't pay attention to it. We don't read it. We don't pursue it. And when we don't pursue it, we become just objects of the flesh, consumers of the flesh. We don't have a dichotomy where there's flesh and spiritual. We're all one person. I'm not trying to create a dichotomy, but it's where that one person is focused. Are we focused on spiritual things? If we are, we will become spiritual people over time. If we're focused on just the flesh, consuming, we will become just that. And it's our choice to make. But if we hope for revival in our own life, or we hope to pass something down to the next generation that will keep them from walking off the disastrous edge of poor decisions, it seems to me it's got to be more than stuff. It's got to be a deep, burning desire to know God personally. Let's pray. Lord, you are really good to us, and we are easily distracted and finite. We want to approach you with the prayer of Nehemiah, recognizing our weaknesses, but thanking you for your greatness and for your reaching out to us continually with the good saving acts that you have done for us. Thank you for being a good God. In Jesus' name, amen.